From the Sky News Centre at 5, the High Court's ruled previously withheld files detailing the alleged torture of a former Guantanamo Bay detainee should now be released. Binyam Mohammed says he was abused while in US custody and that UK agents knew about it. The Foreign Secretary says he'll appeal against the decision. Our political correspondent Glenna Glazer says David Miliband doesn't want to damage relations with the US.
He's making the point that this is not about the allegations, nor is it about, he says, the contents. What it's about is this fundamental issue of trust.
The controversial Dutch MP who wants to ban the Koran says his visit to Britain is a victory for free speech. Geert Wilders was met with angry protests from Muslims when he arrived in Westminster just days after overturning a Home Office ban. Many Muslim demonstrators waved placards reading Sharia is coming. Police believe a woman's given birth to a baby boy and dumped his body in a wheelie bin. Detectives have been trying to identify the infant's mother since his body was discovered wrapped in a black bin liner in Lincolnshire yesterday. Boyzone star Stephen Gately's body has arrived back in Dublin. Ronan Keating, Mikey Graham, Shane Lynch and Keith Duffy escorted his coffin from Mallorca. They'll hold an overnight vigil in church ahead of tomorrow's funeral. Ronan says they're concentrating on getting through the next few days.
What the future holds for the four of us now is too hard to even think about. But we know that nothing will ever be the same without our dearest friend Stephen. Rest in peace, brother.
Police in Colorado are meeting to discuss whether any action should be taken over last night's dramatic balloon chase. Six-year-old Falcon Heaney, who was thought to be inside it, was later found hiding in an attic. He's since hinted it was a stunt. And producers of The Simpsons have invited fans to create a new character for the show. The competition's to mark the cartoon's 20th anniversary. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Hardiman.
This is Hardiman. Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and in the studio with us this week for the first hour of the show is Dan Norris, Minister for Waste and Recycling and also MP for Wansdyke. Our regular Old Labour economics expert Martin Summers is here too. We'll be reviewing some of the last week's news stories as well as hearing what you think of Conservative Party leader David Cameron, courtesy of Marina Morris. Is he the right man to lead the Conservative Party into the next general election? To start the second hour at 6, Billy Quain will be here too with the WEEZ Weekend Reviews and giving us some ideas of free events in and around Bristol, followed by our weekly State of the City chat. On to our guests and discussing this week's news in a moment, but first here's our two-week Friday Drive Time weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, temperatures averaging 11 degrees Celsius in the daytime, but bright and sunny weekend, so it's cold and sunny. Next week, around about 13 degrees Celsius, a little bit warmer, plenty of cloud though, and some rain, some sunny spells in the afternoons later in the week. Next weekend, that's the 24th and 25th of October, we're looking at, again, quite cold, averaging 12 degrees in the daytime, but dry with plenty of sunny spells, so pretty similar to this weekend. That was the long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight from metcheck.com. Well, on to our guests, and with us in the studio this week is Dan Norris. He's the Labour MP for Wansdyke and Minister for Waste and Recycling. Dan, welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Charlie.
Now, Minister for Waste and Recycling, that's not the most glamorous ministerial position, is it?
It's one of the most important, though. I think how we actually respond to the whole issue of waste and recycling will determine how effectively we are in fighting climate change. And so it's a huge responsibility and something we've got to get right.
What are your views then on climate change? Is it all man-made, or is it part of the Earth's natural cycle?
Well, I think the evidence is getting pretty overwhelming now. I think very few people can really turn to the expertise that's now available on this subject and actually say it's not to do with man. And if you look at the graphs of the timings of the Industrial Revolution and the increase in CO2 and temperatures, it's pretty clear cut, I think.
Now, okay, so how long have you yourself been an MP?
I was first elected in 1997, so coming up for 13 years.
And are you from Somerset yourself, from the same area as you're serving?
I am, yeah. I'm a local lad, and I've always loved living here, and I wouldn't want to be anywhere else.
Now, your Wansdyke constituency is sort of wrapped round, is it round about the southeast corner of Bristol and out towards Radstock, yeah, places like that? Sort of. What are the main towns?
Well, it's south of Bristol and kind of east of Bristol, and going across towards Bath. So it's places like Keynsham, which many people, of course, will know as they travel across from Bristol to Bath on the train. And it goes right the way down to Radstock and Midsummer Norton area, but it also includes the Chew Valley, and goes right the way across south and, in fact, east of Bath. So it's a large diamond-shaped constituency, about 30 miles wide by about 20 miles deep.
Yeah, and it's very rural as well, so you must be in a bit of a battle there with the Conservatives. How did you manage to clinch that then, do you think, at the last election, well, the election before last? I mean, what was it, do you think, that clinched it? Because most of these rural constituencies around here are Conservative, aren't they?
Yeah, I think it's because there's always been a strong Labour tradition in northeast Somerset, which the Wansdyke seat covers, and that's of course to do with the coal mining tradition over many years, where you know thousands of men worked underground, including my grandfather, between the wars, and they laboured and toiled under very tough conditions, frankly. And I think that experience has not just affected them and their families, but actually a lot of other people who you know were involved in and saw the work that they did.
But I mean, now as you're campaigning against climate change, I'd imagine that you're very anti-coal, even though your previous generations and your family worked in the industry.
Well, I'm not anti-coal, but I'm anti the pollution that coal produces. And so the challenge is to use technology to take out the bad bits and keep the good bits.
But you can't have one without the other, can you?
I think you can in the future. I think carbon capture is a way of doing that. But look, we have to be really, really clever in how we use a whole range of different kinds of fuels to power our country. That means partly nuclear, and I used to be quite strongly anti-nuclear at one time. But sometimes when you're in between a rock and a hard place, you have to choose the best option available. So I think we do need a component of nuclear, not least so that we're not overly dependent on other countries in the world where they're not so stable. So places like the former Russia or the current Russia. The Middle East obviously is not a stable place very often. So I think we need a whole range of things. But what we have to build towards is renewables. So, you know, wind, sun, geothermal, all sorts of different kinds of other natural sources, because at the end of the day, that is the only way we're going to actually be okay.
Now, we had quite a lengthy discussion last week here about the prospect of having new build nuclear power stations on the edge of the Bristol Channel, which is already one of the most most crowded areas of nuclear in the world, really. So, I mean, would you be happy if there was another nuclear power station built, say, for example, at Hinkley Point?
Well, happy is too strong a word. I'd be content. I mean, the truth is that we have had Barclay and Albury nuclear power stations. I used to be on the liaison committee for those when I was a councillor years ago. The truth is that nuclear power does have a part to play. The Bristol Channel provides the necessary way that you can keep those reactors cool. And I think lots of people, certainly around Thornbury area and further down the Bristol Channel, already recognise that nuclear power doesn't do some of the things that some of its critics claim. So we probably inevitably will get any new power stations because we already understand how the technology works and have got used to it. But of course, if you were to put a nuclear power station somewhere completely where they haven't had a history of that, there'd be very strong opposition, and you can understand that.
Okay. Now, one of the big stories we had, which was made the national press, was the fact that the Bristol City Council has decided that, in its wisdom, that it wants to reduce the size of all our wheelie bins. And one of the most obvious things there is, what's going to happen to all the old wheelie bins? Aren't they just going to be waste themselves and create even more waste?
Well, I'm sure they're made of recycled plastic. I sincerely hope so.
Mine
certainly is. But look, I think that it's a real challenge about how we get people to change their behaviour. And we have to look at whatever is the best solution in each local area. And obviously, if you live in a community where there are high-rise blocks, it's not easy to have great big wheelie bins. You need something smaller because you just can't get it to where you need to when it's going to be collected. On the other hand, if you represent some of the areas like I do, where they're very leafy suburbs and people are more prosperous, there's more space, so perhaps they can have bigger bins and it won't impact on their lives too much. But what is important is that wherever we are, we do the best, first of all, not to produce waste in the first place. I think sometimes people forget that. They think we should, you know, recycle and reuse. But actually, the best thing of all is not to produce waste in the first place. But then if you have to do that, and inevitably we produce some waste, we've got to do our very best to get energy from the waste that we've produced, reuse or recycle. And if we do that effectively, I think we can combat what is a real challenge of climate change. But I don't want to be doom and gloom, because I think people often talk in sort of dark prose about this. I think it's eminently possible for us to change it. I think that we really do have a difficulty in dealing with the consequences of our history. You know, the Industrial Revolution produced a lot of CO2. In fact, Britain as a nation has produced the second biggest amount of CO2 in the history of the planet. Only the USA beats us. No other country, not even China or India, comes anywhere near close to us in that, because we've been going so long as an industrialised nation. I think we have a moral responsibility, among other things, to lead the way on this. And I'm very proud that the Labour government is actually doing a lot to commit money to dealing with this problem, because lots of people talk a good talk, but actually what you have to do is match it with resources.
But back to the wheelie bins. I mean, people have had to put up with having their actual waste recycling, at least a normal waste collections, halved. And now they're being told you can have even less room to put the waste in. And I think for many people looking at this, they're thinking, well, hang on a minute, we're just being told we can't use waste. We have waste, and it ends up just landing on the streets with vermin eating it, foxes, seagulls. Seagulls love this, of course. Mm. If there's extra, you know, if the bin is full up and there's food coming out of it and that sort of thing. But it's not very good for public health, is it?
No, I agree. I mean, I think there has to be local solutions, and obviously Bristol politicians, the councils have to work closely with the community, because they're there to serve the community. It's not the other way around. And it's clearly unacceptable to have food and other waste spilling over and drawing in other vermin and things. But look, it's not for the government to say this is how everywhere should do it. What it is for the government to say is, look, these are the examples of best practice. This is where they collected waste and recycled it and reused it very effectively in other parts of the country. Consider this. And we'll do all we can to support you in that. And we try and use carrots wherever possible, but sometimes it needs sticks, and that's why we have a landfill tax, which has done more in some ways to change the behaviour of councils, because they're having to think, no, we can't throw away things straight to landfill, which I think is absolutely right. And actually, those councils who have got the common sense to kind of embrace that quickly are learning that it's to their advantage, because a lot of what we throw away is very valuable. Many of the metals that we throw away, wood, plastics, have quite a value in themselves. They might be considered waste in a historic sense, but actually, if you look at what they are and their value on an open market, you can see that they actually can produce quite a lot of money. So councils, if they do this right, can actually reduce our council taxes as well as do the right thing by the planet.
Now, we've heard some horrible stories recently. This is something I came across. This is even 10 years ago on the recycling scene in Oxfordshire, is glass being landfilled. People are going to all this trouble to recycle glass, and then they're finding out that actually the glass recycling system can't cope with the amount of glass that's being recycled, so the glass is simply being dumped in landfill. Now, the thing is, of course, that people have made these extra car journeys often to make sure that their glass is recycled, and then this stuff is just being landfilled. This is crazy, isn't it?
Well, that is crazy, and what's more, it demotivates people to do the right thing, and that's the last thing I want as the recycling minister. So, you know, I am very keen that these stories don't keep happening. I think it's inevitable in some instances. I have to be honest about this, because I think we're in this transition phase where we're having to get people to change their behaviour and set up new systems. And if we wait for the new system to be put in place, people's behaviour won't have changed, and we have to do both, in truth. So it is difficult, and I have seen the stories only this week where, you know, binmen have allegedly taken people's recycled materials and just chucked them in the same hole, and that clearly isn't good. But, you know, that's all the more reason why the government has to work effectively to say very clearly, you can't put stuff in landfill, because that forces councillors then to do the things we want them to do, which is to recycle all our materials, be it glass or wood or metals or older electronic goods like, you know, iPhones or whatever it might be, because they have a value too, and they have many pollutants in them, but they also have many valuable metals that we need to reuse. Because remember, everything we reuse is stuff we don't have to dig up in the first place, so you know, it makes sense on every level.
What about reusing? You mentioning that there, but I can remember as a youngster, the milk bottles used to get reused. There was no need to smash the glass up in a bottle bank or whatever. The structure could be there, couldn't it? Where all sorts of containers and packaging that we use is simply reusable, can be cleaned and used again, and it doesn't have to go sort of back to be pulp down, which obviously takes much more energy than reusing something. So why do you think that the we're in this society now where this kind of packaging is just where this packaging is wasted? Why can't we build reusing into the way that we do things, like we did, you know, in my childhood in the late 60s and early 70s?
Well, there's absolutely no reason why we can't, but we've got to, if you like, learn from our grandparents and our parents even, because I think this slightly older than you, but I'm roughly the same generation. I remember milk bottles being collected and putting them out and rinsing them and all the rest of it, and the clink of it in the morning.
In fact, we even used to go around picking up bottles and taking them back to the shop and getting tuppence for them. You know,
the Corona pop bottle.
That's right.
Yep.
Yeah. So this
is my favourite, I have to say.
What I can't quite understand is, you know, how it can be cost effective for anybody to be doing. I suppose it's just simply to do with the transport cost of taking these reusable containers back to the plant, you know, to be then cleaned and refilled.
I think
it may be cheaper for them to get new bottles or whatever from the factory.
It's more fundamental than that, Tony. If you think of our grandparents, and many of them would have grown up post-war, they would have darned socks. They wouldn't have bought a new pair of socks. They would have no more thought of throwing things away, like food, than flying. That's why you have recipes like Bubble and Squeak. It's about reusing what you've got. And actually, we've got to go back to those values, because I think the bubble's burst now. I think we have, in the last 30 years, been in a sort of period of prosperity, if you like, that has made us forget the importance of things. So we've if you like, we've known the value of everything, but not the worth of everything. And I think we're going to go back to some of the traditional values. And I don't mean that in a John Major sense, because that's clearly nonsense. But I think in terms of food and recycling and everything else, it's really important. And, you know, lots of us today, and I include myself in that, will, you know, make a journey to where the petrol station sells a litre of fuel at a few tenths of a pence less a litre. And yet, actually, I'd be much better off looking at the third of food that I buy that I waste every month along with everybody else. We actually throw away tons of stuff, and for the average family, that's £60 a month, and that's an awful lot of money. So it's not just the right thing to do, because food that rots down produces methane, which contributes to climate change, but actually it saves us a lot of money. So it's good for the planet and it's good for our pocket. And so I think on every level, it's the right thing to do.
Okay. Well, Martin Summers is joining us too. He's been very quiet so far because I haven't asked him anything. But anyway, Martin, by way of introduction this week, I'm going to try something a little bit different. And you were chatting to me yesterday, or maybe the day before, about some research work you did whilst you were at the Bristol Debt Advice Centre, which I was absolutely fascinated about, which was looking at best practice with regard to how to deal with people who are in debt, and looking at how local authorities, through the council tax collection system, can actually find a way of dealing with people who are in debt rather than just prosecuting them. Can you just talk about that for a minute?
I've worked on this piece of research at Bristol Debt Advice Centre. The issues surrounding this are the council tax itself, which is actually son of community charge. So in actual fact, it's charged per head rather than on property, as the rates used to be. The fact that people are charged per head is actually rather iniquitous, and the Liberal Democrats, for example, have put forward the idea of a local income tax. In Northern Ireland, they still have the rates. There's actually a varied pattern across the UK. But the point I was making about, in this piece of research, was that iniquitous as the council tax is, what it does is it picks up those low-income people who are having difficulties with paying their debts. It's a trigger for recognising those who are in most difficulty. So every year, without fail, especially in inner city areas, large numbers of people fail to pay their council tax. That's not because they don't want to pay. It's usually because they can't pay. And these people are usually people on low wages or casual employment. People on benefits are waived council tax. So that there's a slice of people there who, year in, year out, and of course as the recession deepens, probably more and more people who are going to fall into this hole. Now, what local authorities need to, I mean, we need to reform the council tax. Can I say that, please, while the Minister is listening? And we haven't, as a party, taken this seriously in all the years we've been in power. In Scotland, the SNP did bring forward a local income tax proposal, but they didn't have the numbers in the Scottish Parliament. They may well do after the next election. But let's just say that surely council tax must be on, we must be looking at it because it's a dreadfully an unfair, regressive tax. It discourages work because people go into work and immediately it kicks in. And it also discourages political participation, which was one of the goals behind the original community charge. But leaving all that aside, as it still exists, it does give you a very clear snapshot, an absolutely accurate snapshot, year on year, for local authorities of the people who are potentially in trouble with other debts, because that's usually why they can't pay. Now, we need a proactive policy by local authorities not to chase these people into court and send bailiffs after them. That's ridiculous. What we need to do is contact them early and try and sort out not just their council tax problems, but their other problems. Debt support is something that no government of any political stripe should be cutting back at this moment. There should be resources made available for people who are in debt. It's absolutely crucial. If you're going to build a recovery around government investment in debt support is... And the knock-on effect of that, when people know about debt, they can tell other people how to manage them. We need to get more aware of how debt works.
Well, Dan is here. Dan, I mean, many of us remember the poll tax riots, the Battle of Trafalgar, I think they called it, and the whole idea of shifting local taxation away from local property owners onto just all the people who are living in the houses has been immensely problematic and quite socially divisive. So could you explain why the two Labour governments, last Labour governments, haven't dealt with this?
It's because it's very, very difficult to find a solution that everybody likes, and every government throughout history has struggled. In fact, for probably 100 years, governments have struggled to find a system that meets all the challenges of raising tax in a fair way. And I think that it seems very clear to me that the council tax could clearly be better. But whenever you put forward a way that you do that, you create winners and losers. And governments, because they're dealing with important things like investment in the NHS or education or whatever, don't want to take on too many battles at once. So that's what happens, I'm afraid. But does it need reforming? Yes. How has it got to be reformed? That's a much more difficult question. And who are winners and who are losers is always key in governments, because you have to take people with you, not do people down.
Of course, one of the frightening things Martin mentioned there is that it's actually a disincentive for people to vote. Now, you know, if you register for the council tax, then you may, if you register to vote, then the local authority's got all your details and they'll come after you for the council tax. But if you don't, you may be able to go under the radar. This is really quite a scary system. It means people are disenfranchised enough, feel disenfranchised enough anyway, and have been voting less and less in this country over the last 20 or so years. This is even less of an incentive, particularly for very low-income people. Now, I would have thought a Labour government would have thought, well, this is a real priority. We must make sure that these low-income people are voting. Otherwise, we're going to be out.
Well, we have tried very hard to make it more easy for people to vote, whatever their circumstances or backgrounds. But we've hit quite a lot of problems, because whenever you change something to make it more straightforward to register to vote or to participate in our democracy, you then have headlines in the media where they will cite all the examples of where people have abused that new system to suggest that that's the norm. And, you know, I very much regret that the fact that we were... You know, having all postal vote areas, for example, isn't something that we could have expanded right across the country. Now, in terms of linking it to how much tax you pay, well, that is clearly going to have that impact, and that's part of the challenge. But let's be clear, you know, women didn't have the vote until fairly recently in our history, unbelievably. People had to be property owners until fairly recently in our history to be able to vote. We are moving in the right direction. It's a real, real challenge, and I don't pretend it's easy, because if it had been easy, we probably would have the solution and we wouldn't be talking about it now.
Martin, what are your thoughts? Do you have a solution? You normally do on occasions like this.
Well, I think the solution is the way we've funded local taxation in this country for hundreds of years, since the time of Queen Elizabeth. It's called the rates. And they still have it in Northern Ireland. And the reason they didn't try and change the rating system in Northern Ireland, which does lead to property owners paying more and those in inner city areas with less resources paying less, the reason they didn't do it in Ireland was because there was a civil war going on, and the army and the police and the intelligence services said, don't you dare try and fiddle with this. So in actual fact, what you've got in Northern Ireland is a situation where prosperous, largely Protestant areas pay more, and the money is spent in less prosperous nationalist areas, and that is the price of peace. And the fact is that that system works for them, and there's no reason why we couldn't go back to a similar system now. We would actually just reinvent the rates. I'm actually not in favour of local income tax because it's, again, based upon individuals paying. What you really need is a properly constituted local property tax. It's quite straightforward, really. And property can't move, property can't run away, property can't evade. If people don't pay, you just impound the building. There's all kinds of very practical reasons why that works. The problem we've had is that the reforms of the Conservative era have become embedded in the political culture. And I do appreciate the problems with trying to reform once they're in there. Once you try and change the system, the people who lose are going to complain. But I think we're going to face more battles like this going forward, because as resources shrink in this recession, depression, whatever it is, somebody has to lose, somebody has to pay. And I think we're going to go back to a more old-fashioned style of politics where poorer people are going to be encouraged to go to the ballot box to buy through their vote things that they can't buy in the marketplace and make others who are wealthier and better off pay for it. And we might as well put that up front.
OK, well, let's go on now to have a look at some of this week's news stories. I'm starting off here with the head of MI5, who appeared in Bristol over the last few days. It was last Friday. No, it's actually yesterday or today. He was at Bristol University, and he issued a powerful defence, apparently, according to today's Evening Post, of Britain's cooperation with intelligence agencies in America and other countries who are accused of the abuse and torture of detainees. He believes that this torture saved British lives. Speaking last night at a private event, as I said, at Bristol University, to mark 100 years of MI5, he said we would have been derelict in our duty if we had not worked with foreign agencies encountering the threat from Al-Qaeda. And he seems to think that torture is an important part of that, of some sort. So, anyway, Dan, do you want to start by saying what you think of this idea of is torture really necessary?
Well, the straight answer is I'm sure that torture on occasion does lead to saving lives, but that doesn't mean that it's something we should use, because I think you have to look at it in the round, and you have to look at it not just in the short term but the medium and long term. And I believe that torture is an injustice. It's more than that. It's criminal. And if you take up those kind of ways or have associations with those kind of behaviours, it leads to consequences. And the consequences are that you motivate other people to carry on doing some of the things that you claim to be sorting out through this torture stuff. So it's a very difficult one. I come from a Quaker family, so many of my family members are pacifists. Now, I'm not as good as they are, because if someone tried to kill me, I'd probably kill them first. But what I would say is that I do believe that you do have to use force sometimes, but it's force that is not involving torture, which I think is just so morally bankrupt as well as ineffectual in the medium and long term. So it's just something I don't really think we should buy into. But you have to be honest in this debate as well and say that, you know, I think it's difficult when you look at your own times and make these judgments. But if you look at things like the Second World War, where clearly the Nazi regime were so awful and so evil, it is a difficult dilemma for people who we ask to work, in secret, spies, if you like, to say to them, you know, would they not hurt others to get information that might save their fellow citizens back home? You know, it is a hard judgment for them. And I think we have to respect the difficult calls they have to make under pressure, often at short notice. But I think we have to be very clear at a governmental level. It's not acceptable. We don't want any part of it. And if people are blasé about that, there will be consequences that are serious for them, but also recognizing, you know, the very difficult task we ask our spies. You know, let's be clear about this. Some of our people, some of our spies get killed, and they are in foreign countries doing things, trying to keep an eye on what's going on and pick up information, and they get killed and they get tortured too. And we just have to be to show that our culture is superior and better, because we don't fall down and succumb to those quick fixes, or seemingly quick fixes, which actually say a lot more about us if we succumb.
There seems to be a bit of a divide between the politicians and the intelligence people on this, doesn't there? The intelligence people seem to be constantly pushing for torture, the politicians constantly against it. Who's really in charge?
No, I don't agree with that. I think all the people, I mean, I've had quite a lot of dealings with our security services, because I was Peter Haynes' aide in Northern Ireland during the peace process, which was very successfully concluded, of course. And I realised some of the pressures that those guys are under. And I was similarly an aide for David Miliband, the Foreign Secretary, until I became a minister earlier this year. I don't think the security services do feel that torture is right. In fact, I know they don't think that. But what I think you've got to understand is that we are not being honest if we think that our security services don't sometimes get very close to the line because of the nature of their work and the dangers they face and the value of the information that they can obtain that they feel might do a lot of good in the very short term. And we can all think of dilemmas like that, you know. Would you shoot someone if you knew that they were about to drive a car into a house and blow it up where people you knew lived? It's a sort of moral dilemma. But I think at a government level, it's no dilemma at all. You can be very clear. You can say, no, torture is not acceptable. I understand that our people out in the field are going to find that tough sometimes because they're going to be in tough situations. But that doesn't take away from the fact that at a moral level, it is never acceptable. And actually, I would argue very strongly that at a pragmatic level, it doesn't work in any case.
There is this case of Binyam Mohammed, I think, which is still ongoing, where it looks like that torture was used in an attempt to extract a confession. I mean, as soon, surely, as we start allowing torture, that kind of thing can happen too.
Yeah, it can. But look, I'm not going to make any judgments about that case, because what I also know is that the very freedoms that my grandparents fought, you know, my grandfather was tortured by the Japanese, my other grandfather had a very tough time in Africa in the Eighth Army. He fought for freedoms, they both fought for freedoms that I cherish and I stand up for. And because of those freedoms, some people can tell lies and exaggerate and suggest that bad things are happening when they're not. And I don't take away from people will do that, but I think we've all got to kind of step back a bit and move away from some of the headlines and just get back to basics. You know, is torture acceptable? No, it isn't. And we ought to know that better in Britain than anybody else, because actually we have got an awful history of producing lots of machinery of torture going back hundreds of years. You think of Guy Fawkes and all that area. I'm afraid Britain had the reputation of producing we made a lot of equipment that was exported around the world to torture and force confessions out of people. It's a terrible history we have. So that gives us, if you like, the advantage of having to think this through the longest, perhaps, of any culture in the world, arguably. And I think it's just very clear that torture is never acceptable morally, but also because it actually doesn't work.
OK, let's bring Martin in here. Martin, were you rather surprised to see the head of MI5 in Bristol yesterday evening coming out with this sort of thing about really a kind of a defence of torture, I suppose?
Well, I'm not surprised, but it's still rather odd. I mean, I agree, obviously, that torture is wrong. But what does seem to be happening here is torture is wrong as long as we don't know enough about it to say what's actually happening. And I often think politicians do defer to the security services far more than they ought. What I pick up from something Dan said earlier, which is torture is criminal. It is a criminal offence. Anybody in the British services caught torturing people or in close to being accomplices to torture. I understand there have been officers who have said that when they were being asked to work with material obtained by torture, they were approaching their line managers and saying, am I going to be prosecuted for this? That is quite the correct response. It's the correct response because we're trying to defend the rule of law here. The rule of law is not defended by attempts to defend the indefensible, which is what MI5 are doing. I think the fellow is absolutely overstepping his political role. He should be probably disciplined or sacked. If we expect young Muslims to abide by the rules, then we've got to expect our people to abide by the rules. And if we look at what's happened in Northern Ireland, Dan, the support by the nationalist community for the police service of Northern Ireland is very much what we need to see. And that can only happen when everybody in all sections of the community are confident about what is actually happening. And I think there's very good suspicions, as we know in Northern Ireland, that the security services were not just involved in peacekeeping. And we know that the other things have happened in other parts of the world. We mentioned our history of torture. In Kenya, British National Servicemen tortured thousands of Kikuyu, many of them to death. All of this is historical fact, as is the torture academy run by the United States in Georgia, known as the School of the Americas, where all of the top torturers in Latin America were trained by US trainers, our allies. And the people in Pakistan know this history, even if people in Bristol and do not. Now, I think if we're going to deal with all of that historical baggage, there's got to be an absolutely clear line drawn. And I would like to see a much greater role for the police services, just like the PSNI, in investigating all terrorism. to make sure that there's absolutely no hint whatever that other elements are going, that other things are going on than appear to be the case. And we know the history of what happened in Ireland. Plenty of things went on which were brushed under the carpet. We've now got a peace process, and I congratulate Dan on his role in bringing that about, that process. And he will have understood how important it is to get this principle right, that all sections of the community can have confidence in the civilian police force to prosecute whoever is out of line, and that includes security service personnel, army, whoever is out of line, and anybody else.
Well, I don't particularly disagree with any of what Martin said, but I think we have to be really candidly honest about this. Look, I don't think there's a security services of any nation in the world that probably doesn't kill people, to be honest. And I think we all duck that, and I'm, you know, as a government minister, I am trying to be fair about this. And the real issue is about how accountable people like me, politicians, can make our security services. Because if they have spies who kill people, I dare say they don't tell government ministers, even though they're meant to. And this is how, this is the tension that you have, in a, especially in a democratic society, because obviously you don't expect that in dictatorships, but in a democratic society, it's about really knowing what our security services are doing, probably guessing what they sometimes get up and involved in, saying very clearly that criminal acts are not ever acceptable, but on the other hand, recognising that if they are in very difficult situations and scrapes, that sometimes difficult things happen and terrible things happen. And you know, in a sense, that's the definition of a civilized society, isn't it? Is that we, despite all those pressures, have to rise above it to have absolute standards that we say cannot be crossed. That is the very difference between us and a dictatorship. And I don't want to pretend it's easy, because I think we ask some very brave people to do some very difficult things for us, where they must be facing lots of dangers, being tortured themselves, no doubt, sometimes being killed themselves. And we must recognise that they are human beings too, but that never, ever, ever excuses torture or other criminal behaviour.
Well, do you think there's enough oversight of the security services in this country, Dan? I mean, you're someone who's been quite close to them over the years. I mean, I get the impression that they do think that they can sort of get away with stuff without MPs actually ever finding out about it sometimes.
No, there's never enough oversight of security services. As soon as you think that, you're in big trouble. I think you have to have... I don't think it means that you go around accusing people falsely, but as a government minister, I always have a healthy scepticism, if you like, of what our security services do, because you know, our history shows that we have done some pretty bad things that at the time politicians were told didn't occur. And we know that in recent history, for example, that IRA people were shot by our army on orders. That clearly was wrong. That was more than wrong. It was criminal. People justified it because they said the IRA were terrible. That it is absolutely true. The IRA were terrible, were murderers. But I believe that governments and civilized governments have to rise to that challenge. That's what makes them special, if you like. And that's what, you know, that's why we have to work so hard to have those standards, because once you get into the slippery slope, it leads up in anarchy and real chaos. Look, I just think the Northern Highland Police process shows what is possible, because actually some pretty terrible things happened, and by that I think it's self-evident what the IRA did, but I think we have to be very honest that some of our security forces, some of our army, some of our police did terrible things too, and part of getting resolution to conflict is actually about being candidly honest and having to move forward with the pain that lots of people will feel as a result of that violence. And it's a tough call, and that's why Tony Blair did amazingly well, and I think history will judge that to be probably the achievement of the late 20th century.
Well, staying with the military theme, the Ministry of Defence has rejected calls to privatise the management of the giant Abbey Wood complex, which employs about 7,000 people up in Filton. This is again today's Evening Post. The long-awaited review by businessman Bernard Gray said the MOD's sclerotic process for buying equipment for the armed forces were inadequate for meeting the demands of modern conflicts like Afghanistan. He said that the current equipment programme was now unaffordable, being an estimated £35 billion over budget, with individual projects running on average 5 years late. Now, it does sound like there's something a little bit wrong up at Abbey Wood. Martin, do you want to start on this one?
The suggestion is that Abbey Wood should be privatised, but they're not going to privatise.
That's right, yeah. There was a suggestion, I think, because of these massive overspends, that maybe it was a good idea to bring private business in to run the place.
Well, the idea of massive overspends leading to privatisation is a non sequitur. I mean, the problem is that you've got government contracting there and a huge private sector which sucks on that central teat. And, of course, there are problems with overruns, because with military supplies, you've got monopoly suppliers by and large. Secrecy and geopolitics mean that you can't open it up to Chinese competition. And so the potential for overspends in the military sector and shoddy goods at the end of it is inevitable. And that's one of the reasons why, of course, countries like Sweden used to have a very successful but nationalised arms industry. And I think arms are special as well. I mean, it shouldn't just be, we shouldn't basically be making weaponry for profit. Weaponry is necessary in the dangerous world we live in, but it shouldn't necessarily be made for profit. And I think that, you know, further attempts to privatise the system will not, in fact, reduce costs. The Pentagon is entirely privatised system of procurement. It's ridiculously over budget.
Well, I mean, call me old-fashioned, but I thought a contract was a contract. You know, if the Ministry of Defence signs a contract with anybody, whether it's someone who's building armoured cars for Afghanistan or protective clothing or whatever, surely if they don't deliver this on budget, they don't get paid. It's as simple as that.
Yes, but the point is you want to retain an arms industry as well. If you don't pay the only supplier of whatever it is you've got, and they've only got one or two to choose from, who else is going to supply it? The Chinese.
But the arms suppliers are shifting the goalposts here, as they're saying now, for an estimated £35 billion.
Well, it's peanuts compared to the Pentagon's overruns. I mean, we've got to get all this under control, but privatisation is not the answer. We've already got a privatised military-industrial complex, which is churning out weaponry. The US is the biggest arms supplier in the world, but we're not far behind. And, of course, a lot of the small arms being produced are ending up being used in conflicts. We need I worked for Amnesty International a few years ago, and they were pushing very strongly for a code of conduct about the sale of small arms. We've really got, if we're going to be serious about fighting terrorism and all the other things that we believe in, then we've got to be serious about controlling weaponry. I mean, what would happen, for example, if Saudi Arabia did have a fundamentalist revolution, which might happen? Then all of the kit we've supplied over the years on TIC will then be used against us. It's crazy.
Well, I'm kind of not really sure whether it should be privatised or not. All I'm concerned about, I think, is just the sheer waste of it, because that's an awful lot of money that could be spent on many important things. Now, some people might argue it should be on defence-type stuff, but I can think of 101 things, and I'm sure your listeners can too, that they would rather see that money spent on. So it's the sheer waste of it that I'm sort of hit by. But I have to say that this is not a new phenomenon. This is something that's always happened, not just in defence issues. It's just we get to hear about those things because we get to hear the reports and hear what Parliament has to say about it. But look, I think the real issue here is about the quality of management. I think it doesn't matter whether it's privatised or public. What we need is good quality managers making good decisions that aren't wasteful. And I've always thought that Britain has got into this odd argument about private or not private, when actually what we should be saying is we want good management and better management than we currently have. And I think that would help a great deal in cutting down on this waste.
But surely, I mean, if it's privatised, then there's even less control from the politicians over the management. I mean, with these private businesses, everything becomes kind of commercially confidential and very much at arm's length. Why is it that privatisation, do you think, would actually make things better?
I'm not sure that it would. I think it just depends. I think it's the quality of the management. It's the decision making, and I think that in some instances a private system is best. In others, a public one is. But what I think we can all agree on that this is unacceptable waste, and something needs to change. And I don't think it's right that we should rule out any solution just because we feel it has particular advantages or disadvantages. What we've got to do is weigh up and be bespoke about this. I think that's all I can really say about it, except it's just awful waste and it makes you go mad. But the other thing I'd say is don't think that it's just about the defence industry. There are lots of wastes that go on in private sector that we never hear about because they're commercially sensitive. Lots of computer contracts are wasteful. Lots of companies have to write off huge amounts of money, but we're never told about them, of course, because if you heard they've been so wasteful, people wouldn't invest in them in the future.
But do you think many of these private companies, particularly arms companies, who are pretty canny people, see the government as a bit of a soft touch?
No, I think there is a danger of that, because I think that they are able to play play that card quite effectively, to be selective in the information they provide to government. And I think it ever was thus, sadly. But that's a reason for us to raise our game, isn't it? And to be more sceptical. But it's difficult when there isn't much choice, I'm afraid. And also that so many jobs depend on it. I mean, it's a very brave Bristol area politician who would argue strongly against the defence industries when so many of our fellow citizens and neighbours actually rely on those jobs that it creates.
Right. Now, we move on to our next subject, where Marina Morris is with me. Hello, Marina. Today, hello. You have been looking at the popularity of David Cameron and the Conservative Party. So we'll have a report for you for a little while, and then Martin and Dan will have a chat about it afterwards.
Yes, Tony. A topic very near to the hearts of many people in Bristol is MPs' expenses. Mr. Cameron, a former public relations executive, is said to play the Daily Mail test prophetically, asking how a claim would look on the front page of a tabloid newspaper. He has been reported as having some of the most straightforward expenses claims of any member of the shadow cabinet. His self-imposed guidelines is not whether something is just within the rules set down by Parliament, but also, if it were to become public, to consider how it will be look splashed across the front page of the tabloid paper. For most of the past five years, Cameron has claimed only for mortgage interest and utility bills on his constituency cottage in Oxfordshire. His claims for some years are said to run to just 20 pages. Compare this more than 90 pages for some of his colleagues. The Conservatives' leader's only extra was £680 he claimed for repairs to the property. The Prime Minister Gordon Brown claimed thousands of pounds for mortgage interest, cleaning and furnituring at the privately owned flat in Westminster, then changed the designation of his second home to his Scottish constituency, enable him to carry on claim after he moved into Downing Street. He has already repaid more than £300 for items he had wrongly claimed for, but that amount is tiny compared to the sum of £12,415, which he agreed to repay as a result of a Sir Thomas Legge's review. Most of the money, about £10,700, relate to payments to clients who serve Mr. Brown's homes in London and Scotland, earning considerably more than £2,000 per year limit imposed by Sir Thomas. Comparing the leaders of the two biggest parties, Mr. Cameron seems to hold the expenses moral high ground. All 646 MPs have now been contacted after Sir Thomas Legge's review. Locally, near £3,000 will have to be repaid to Parliament by two of the nine local Bristol MPs after this examination of their expenses for the last 5 years. But what do the people of Bristol think about Mr. Cameron and his party?
Do you trust David Cameron?
No, I don't.
No, I'm just like it.
Personally, I'm not a fan of the Tory party. I don't really believe he has the strength to be Prime Minister in this country, but also neither does Gordon Brown. So I'm kind of at a loss with politics in this country at the moment.
Not hugely, no. I think he gives off a his persona is comes across as being a little bit ingenuine, and I suppose I've a natural distrust of senior Conservative Party members in general, just because of the sort of the history of the party. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much why.
Oh, Chris, I'm a Labour.
I do. I think it is the future of British politics.
No. Politicians are all the same. They'll tell you what they want and do the opposite.
I have no reason not to trust him. He appears to be honest, mm-hmm. as far as I know. Well, I normally vote Labour, but I am a bit disappointed in Labour recently, so I'm not necessarily sure that I would choose Conservative.
Yes. Trust? Why do you trust? I don't know. I like him.
No. He's an old style politician. Something we bred from university, something we got from our sort of status, our culture, and the system's failing. Goodbye.
What differences do you expect to see if the Conservatives win the next election?
That's fine. I don't know too much about politics, really. I personally think they don't really connect to Britain in the same way that the Labour government does. They'd have to, drastically change. I think probably get a new a new figure for running for president, prime minister, sorry, if they were to. But I don't really think there's that much they can do, to be honest.
I don't think I don't know really. I don't think people anticipate a great deal of change. I just think that they probably feel that the Labour Party is tied.
To put right what the Labour's managed to put wrong,
not much. I mean, everybody make promises, but they can't always fulfil them. If they do, where's the money coming from? More borrowing, which again ends up with the taxpayers.
To put the country right,
I think David Cameron will win, because I think people are so f***ed up with Labour.
I expect they'll turn the economy around and there'll be even more job losses.
And things will get worse before they get better.
I think it would be very similar in reality. I mean, they make lots of promises, but reality is it would be very, very similar to how it is now.
Who do you think will win the next election?
I think it's just the lesser of two evils, really, because everybody's disillusioned with Labour, but the Conservatives, you know, aren't popular either, to be honest. But I think they'll probably get in power because people just don't want Labour, which isn't a very good state politically, really, for the country anyway. So I think the Conservatives will win just because nobody likes Labour anymore.
I think Labour will win. But I don't think really that will be seeing over the country, but I do think it will be better than the Conservatives. So, like she said, the better of the two evils, really.
I think probably the Conservatives will win, I expect. I think people are probably just a bit tired of Labour Party now, and Conservatives is just the only alternative, really.
The Conservatives?
Labour.
Because the majority of people are Labour people, and it doesn't matter who gets in, there's always a mess to clean up. Then they do it, they tidy it up. Maybe it's a mess again, then you have another election.
I think there's been too much damage, especially with this expensive scandal, that most British people have lost faith in the Labour Party. They've been in, 12 years now, and the average person is no better off for being in this country with a Labour government, so I think the Conservatives will definitely win.
Well, I think there's a strong chance that Conservatives will win, because Labour seems to be doing very badly at the moment. But I would rather not have a Conservative government.
I don't know. I am on the Conservative side, so I think the Conservatives will. We've had enough of the other ones. Yeah.
Labour. Yeah. I don't know.
That's Labour.
Because I think that's who my mum votes for.
Yeah, that's who my mum votes for as well.
Well, one of the recurring themes there, Dan, and I'd like you to just address that if you can before we talk about David Cameron, is this whole thing of the loss of faith and the lesser of two evils. Are you happy about being the lesser of two evils? Actually, of course, there's many more than just two parties, but are you happy with that?
No, of course you're not. You want people to vote for you positively. You don't want people to vote for you because they dislike the others even more.
Yeah, but you haven't got long to turn it around now, have you, before the next election?
Yeah, but look, I think that people do express discontent, and I would expect them to express exactly the discontent we've just heard in the height of what has been the worst economic situation in the world, a global phenomenon, it has to be said, since the 1920s or 1930s. It's tough times for people. They're really worried, and understandably so. They don't know how they're going to pay their mortgages or their rent in some instances. They're really struggling and worried, and that does make people very, very negative and cautious. And of course, you know the name of all the politicians in your locality or in the government. What you don't know is the name of all the bankers. It's very difficult to go and criticise the people you might think are really responsible for this. But look, I think that when it comes to the general election, people will have to think very carefully. They'll have to think, do they want a government that's got a record of having produced the biggest period of growth in 200 years, a very successful record, and then recognise that there have been difficulties that have applied all around the world, clearly not a Labour government's fault, but a phenomenon around the world. And they'll have to weigh that up with what's offered by the Conservatives. And my view is very clear that if you weigh it up on that basis, and we do know it's the economy stupid, I think the Conservatives are very weak in that area. So I think that what you can say now is that the Tories are at the height of their popularity. They actually need to be much more popular than they are at the moment if they're going to win the general election. The current polls suggest, most of them, that actually there'll be a hung parliament in the current situation. But the Tory media is certainly talking it up. That's why some of the people are talking as if a Conservative victory is a shoo-in. I think that's not the case. I think at the moment we've got a hung parliament and there's an awful lot of people who are undecided, and that's something that isn't mentioned.
So you think it's something you can actually turn around?
around that general view we heard there, if that's in any way representative, which I, you know, is just a sort of snapshot of opinion the next election?
I'm going to say, look, what I'm going to say is we're going to do our very best to turn it round, but I'm not going to insult the intelligence of people. They make their decisions. They are our masters, and they decide on the day who they want to support. I will put forward the strongest case that I can to say they should support Labour. But look, what I recognise is that people are being asked if there was a general election tomorrow, how would they vote in these polls? But what the polls don't indicate is that an awful lot of people don't know how they will vote, a much bigger proportion than has happened in previous elections. So that excites me, because that means there's an awful lot of people who've got to make their mind up, and I'm confident that we will make the case and win that argument. But I'm not complacent about that. It's a tough situation, but then it's always tough for governments when they've been in 12 years. And the other thing I'd say is, look, records are going to be broken. People talk and point out how the percentage polling that Labour is getting at the moment is low and how hard it is for any government in that situation to come back and win again. But what I'd also say is there's never been an opposition with such a low polling rating that's gone on to win as well. Records are going to be broken, and I think the context of the expenses scandal does mean that many people are very cynical about the whole political class. They really are feeling fed up, and I'd say that's sad because it's a minority of politicians that have done bad things. Most of the politicians that I know, whatever their politics, are actually very hardworking, very conscientious, and despite all the stuff that's been in the British press, I would argue that we have the least corrupt political system probably in the whole world, and certainly in the Western world.
Martin, that was a quite the general feeling there, loss of faith in the Labour Party from many Bristol voters, and this idea of, well, they may be the lesser of two evils. It's not really a positive people voting for something they really want, is it? It's kind of, oh, well, we're going to have to vote for someone who's the lesser of two evils. It's not ideal.
To be honest with you, Tony, what I heard there was that people are disappointed in the Labour Party in the sense that the things haven't been achieved which might have been achieved, but there's no enthusiasm for a Conservative government there, and as we know, in Bristol is not really a Conservative city. I think the Conservative Party conference, where David Cameron and George Osborne stressed that they were going to cut public expenditure, may prove to be decisive in the end. Danny Blanchflower, who used to be on the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England, commented on Cameron's speech, and he was the chap that actually called the recession right when all of his colleagues on the Monetary Policy Committee were calling it wrong. He's not on it anymore, but he commented and he said Cameron was offering us three options there. One was not to pay our debts, which he said is not serious, and if he's a serious man wanting to be Prime Minister, what's he talking about? The second is to have inflation, and the third was to cut public expenditure. And Danny Blanchflower said, I want to go for option two. Let's have some inflation. We've now got inflation of 1.2% in Britain. That's below the Bank of England's 2% target. I think the Conservatives have lost the plot on the economy. All serious economic analysis suggests that cutting public expenditure at this stage of the game is potentially suicidal. And if they are going to go into a general election with that as their position, I think Dan can get a spring in his step.
Yes, but I mean, it seems that quite a lot of people seem to think that David Cameron has got much more charisma than Gordon Brown has. These are the two main people. Yeah,
well, perhaps we've got to get away from this charisma question and start talking about bankers, interest rates, and jobs.
Well, that's all very well, but that's one of the main things that people vote on. If they think that someone actually is, you know, the sort of person that can fix things out, they may well vote
Cameron's
for them.
Cameron's superficial glitter has been exposed by his non-serious economic policy laid out at his conference. He's a personable enough chap. Frankly, he's the first Tory leader in a generation that's even remotely looked human, and that's regarded as some kind of positive development. And of course it is, because they were in the wilderness for years, because people knew of old that their economic policy was wrong, and then they've managed to gradually come back into the public consciousness as a possible government.
Well, what's so right about Gordon Brown's economic policy? I mean, he's just announced that they're going to be selling off the very, very last scrapings of the barrel of the family silver.
You know my criticisms of the government's economic policy, because I make them every week on this programme. But I would say this, that Gordon Brown did go to the Americans at the height of the crisis last year, and the Americans were chucking money at the Wall Street money centre banks, and Brown wanted to persuade the Americans to nationalise the banks. or to take them into public ownership, to buy shares in the banks rather than just giving them money. The Americans didn't want to know, but Brown bravely, on the way back from Britain, on the way back to Britain, decided that that's what Britain was going to do, and we did, and then the Americans followed suit. That's why I shall be voting for him.
Thanks, Martin. So we say goodbye to our guest, Dan Norris, Labour MP for Wansdyke and Minister for Waste and Recycling. Just coming up very soon, it's the time for the Sky News at 6. We'll be back in a few minutes with music, news and reviews, our State of the City Hour. Maybe, Dan, you could just finish up by telling us if you could change one thing about government and parliament, what would you do?
I think it would be to change the language you use. I think we use far too much techie language that's kind of not understood properly and easily by many ordinary people who are working hard, worrying about their families and who need to understand.
You are listening to BCFM.
Lovely, thanks.
93.2.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.